ओम नमो शिवाय, ओम नमो भगवते रमनाय, अरुणाचला शिवा, ओम अदिया नमलाय, ओम सनत कुमार। I would like to thank Adarsh Kumar Bhatiani ji for extending this invitation to visit the Ramana Kendra Delhi for a talk. The invitation was received before the lockdown and it didn't happen. And so we thought of this one session for members of the Kendra as well as devotees of Bhagwan and all of you who have been regularly attending these talks. At the outset, I would like to add that I am no expert on Ramana Maharshi's teachings. There are people with far greater knowledge and insights. There are many videos on the net. So I was quite surprised to receive this invitation. Pleasantly, of course. Bhagwan certainly doesn't need me to elaborate on his teachings and prattle on and on about them. But I suppose there's a reason for everything. And so one goes with the flow like H2O. The first time I saw Ramana Maharshi's photo was when I visited Ramesh Balsekar in Mumbai to attend his satsangs. And I would see that Rameshji, before entering the satsang room, which was in his house, he would bow down before a photograph of a white-haired and white-bearded man. I didn't know who that man was. This is how I was introduced to Ramana Maharshi. I had not read any of his books. I had no idea about a place called Thiruvannamalai, a holy mountain called Arunachala Shiva. It is only after this visual imprint of my spiritual teacher bowing down before every satsang that the thought arose to pay a visit to the mountain and the ashram. The first visit was in the year, I think, 2000 or 2001. It was the height of summer in May, and me and my dear friend Xavier, we went to visit. We climbed up to the caves, Skandashram, Virupaksha cave, at 12 noon, not knowing how intense the heat would be. We couldn't bear the noise of the town. And after having darshan, we ran away to Pondicherry. I'll never forget that. That was my first visit. And I thought it would be the last. And the next year, my sister called from Hong Kong. We had just published a book. I had gotten into publishing by an accident of fate. And we had just published a book by a Western author. And she said that he is coming to India and he wishes to visit Ramana Ashram, so you need to go. And I said, oh no. strange are the ways of the masters. And so on that visit, some of you might be familiar with the name Eckhart Tolle. I met him at Chennai and we went for a couple of nights to the ashram, climbed the mountain again to the caves, and I was quite nonplussed that I was back within a year to a place I had sworn not to go again to. It reminds me of this James Bond movie, Never Say Never Again. And so I found myself going year after year, just for a few days, to the sacred ground. And a love affair with the mountain began, as well as Bhagwan's books. In fact, my laptop is propped up by a few big fat books, two of which are talks with Ramana Maharshi and Guru Vachaka Kuvai. For those familiar with Bhagwan's books, they will be familiar with this one. And so if not me, at least my laptop is on very solid ground. Today, I would like to take you all briefly through some quotations from this book, Conscious Immortality, based on notes by Paul Brunton. Now, a bulk of this book will be found in talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi, at least 50-60%. And so we will take very simple quotations and go through this message, this master's teaching, and its relevance in today's time. You see, perhaps it is this challenging circumstance, the pandemic, which has forced people, in a sense, to get on to some kind of inward journey. For now, it is everyone's experience that nothing is in one's control. A few had already accepted this fact. Now, with the challenges being faced, with the job losses, the pressures that have mounted up, the economic stress, the health anxieties, these teachings are what take us through the ocean of existence. The highest teachings, more relevant today. Why? Because for the first time, perhaps in our lifetimes, we have seen this level of collective suffering in such a large scale. This shows how truly connected we all are. We are literally in the same boat. Osho was quite right when he said, generally, when we see someone suffering, deep inside we feel happy because we are not suffering. And sympathy arises. But now, this has impacted all of us, or rather most of us, in one way or another. In fact, there is another YouTube channel I speak on called Sai Baba's Devotee Speaks. And the Sai Satcharita, the book based on the Master Sai Baba's Leelas, the first chapter begins with the cholera pandemic. The very first chapter of this book begins with the pandemic at that time, or epidemic, or whatever you call it. So let's begin now. The questioner asks, what is the purpose of all suffering and evil in the world? Bhagwan answers, your question is itself the outcome of the suffering. Sorrow makes a man think of God. Had it not been for the suffering, would you have put the question? Except for the jnani, every man, from king to peasant, has a certain amount of sorrow. Even in cases where it seems absent, it is only a time factor that makes you think so. Sooner or later it comes. Also, one man may not question sorrow or God at the first blow, but he is likely to do so at the fifth blow. And finally, we have taken this vehicle in order to know our real state. We have taken this vehicle of the body, that is, in order to know our real state. And that is why this time, the importance of this time, the churning that is going on and perhaps will go on for a bit more time, the importance to know our real state, to go within, to find out what is truly of value, since so many externals have been taken away from us. So many crutches, so many social pretenses have been suddenly withdrawn because we have not been allowed to socialize like we used to earlier. So much sorrow. So much free time, so many people unable to work like they used to. So much opportunity to seek the real. The only useful purpose of this birth is to turn within and realize there is nothing else to do. The only useful purpose of this birth is to turn within and realize there is nothing else to do. Literally, this is such a time. The dance of Shiva is going on. The unknown is staring us in the face like never before. I just read in yesterday's newspaper that the business of therapists and psychiatrists, etc., has gone up by 400% since the month of March. 400%. That's the ground reality. Now we will explore some of these quotations. Shiva made over all his possessions to Vishnu and wandered in the forests and wilderness and cemeteries and lived on food begged by him. In his view, non-possession is higher in the scale of happiness than the possession of things. The higher happiness is to be free from anxieties. Possessions create anxieties, such as their safeguarding, their utilization. Non-possession does not bring any anxieties in its train. Therefore, Shiva resigned everything to Vishnu and he himself went away happy. Divestment of possessions is the highest happiness. Now, it is not only material possessions. What all is possessed by us here? What all are we identified with? What beliefs? What judgments? What opinions? How things should be? How you feel people should be? Are your possessions, your identifications are your possessions because they are yours. So this paragraph has to be read in terms of not just material possessions, but all possessions, because possession means ego. Me and mine, me and my story. In that sense, my story is also my possession. Because it is about me. No story, no me. It reminds me of an incident a decade ago, which I have shared in my earlier talks, of a very rich family in South Bombay. The lady had these beautiful porcelain figurines in her living room. It was a pair, a man and a woman. And while the lady of the house was sitting in the living room, her husband was reading the newspaper, the maid was dusting the shelves and came to these porcelain figures and picked one up to wipe it. And it fell from her hands onto the floor. And the lady of the house shrieked and screamed and yelled and abused the maid. How dare you do this? Are you stupid? Do you have butterfingers? You don't know the value of this? You know how many thousands of rupees is this? And the rant went on and on and on. And so, the husband, who was a witness to what had happened, put his paper down, saw the maid trembling in fear, crying, and saw the fury of his wife, unabated. And he got up, went to the second figure on the shelf, picked it up and threw it on the floor. And he told his wife, now you don't have to worry if the maid will break the second figure. Possessions. A lady went to Ramakrishna and said how happy and satisfied she was with life. And she said, the only love now I have left is for my children. Otherwise, I'm detached, unconcerned, away from the world. And Ramakrishna said, it's not enough. When you love everyone's children as you love your children, then you come back to me. See, the me and the mine. This distinction is not made by the sage. Perhaps some of you are getting bored by this format of me reading these quotations and you feel drowsy or sleepy. I will take it as a great attainment because Bhagwan has said deep sleep is your natural state. So it's a good thing if this is putting you to sleep, because it is the thinking mind that is being put to sleep. When a man surrenders himself as a slave to the divine Lord, he realizes at the end that all his actions are the actions of God. He loses his mindness. This is what is meant by doing the will of God. This is Siddhanta, the final view, the settled conclusion. When a man realizes that he has lost his ahamkara, his I-ness, and that he is not different from Ishvara, he is a jnani. There are two ways open to one: bhakti and jnana. A bhakta surrenders to God and rests secure in his protection. A jnani knows that there is nothing beside the self and so remains happy. This path is the highest of all and suited only for advanced aspirants. Thus, it is really by the grace that they are brought to this highest path. Of course, they might have practiced the other paths in former existences and thus were born right for this one. Others try other ways and after progressing, finally turn to self-inquiry. But the last lap of all the paths are the same: the surrender of the ego. The surrender of the ego. Not my will, O Lord, but thine be done. And that is what the blows of life teach us, as we began this life. If not the first blow, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth. Fortunate are the ones who get this blow early in life, because their learning begins from them. The difficulty is that man thinks he is the doer. It is a mistake. It is a mistake. It is the higher power which does everything, and man is only a tool. If he accepts that position, he is free from troubles. Otherwise, he courts them. If he accepts that position, he is free from troubles. Otherwise, he courts them. You see how intrinsic this concept of non-doership is to these highest teachings. And my teacher, Rameshji, explained it so simply, like one would talk to children. that if one understood that all of us are shaped by our conditioning, which we had no control over, where we were born, the economic environment we were born in, the school we went to, the religion we were born into, and so on and so forth. All this conditioning was not our choice. And on the basis of this conditioning, we take decisions and perform actions on the basis of our DNA, our genetics, our conditioning. We take decisions and perform actions. So, if our conditioning, if our DNA, if our genetics is not truly ours, but gifted by God, because we didn't create either of these, then truly, is it our action? And more importantly, most importantly, is it the other's action? Now, if this understanding was lived of non-doership, there would be no hate. There would be no individuals left to hate. If one accepted that the other's point of view is as valid as mine, why? Because it is based on his genetics and conditioning, just like mine. If one accepted this, one may not agree with it. You see, that is a separate point. But now no individual is targeted with hate. No individual is targeted with, you are wrong, I am right. You see, these polarities become irrelevant with the teaching. With the understanding of non-doership, all this becomes irrelevant. You deal with what arises in the moment as a happening, not an individual doing something. This is what Bhagwan has emphasized on. And so, what happens if we don't agree with someone? We agree to disagree without being disagreeable. We agree to disagree without being disagreeable. Today, there is so much polarization. Hating certain individuals, hating certain politicians, and so on and so forth. We are operating on a very polarized pendulum, which swings extremely from one side to the other. And the dance of duality goes on and on and on, perpetuated by this. But if one is not identified with an extreme position, the pendulum stops swinging so wildly and then reaches the center point of stillness. So be careful when you take sides, because the minute one does that, one has already created the polaric opposite. To live the teaching of non-doership is to see the world through the eye of singularity, not the eyes of duality. Bhagwan gave the most beautiful illustration of living according to one's nature. Some thieves broke into the ashram one night. And in fact, one of them struck Ramana Maharshi's thigh with a blow. And so the devotees around told Bhagwan that we will go and get sticks and run after and beat up these thieves. And Bhagwan said, is that your nature? Their nature is doing what they did. Their dharma is doing what they did. Now tell me, is that your dharma? Is that your nature? Keeping God in your mind as everything around you becomes dhyana. This is the stage before realization, which is only in the self. Dhyana must precede it. Keeping God in your mind as everything around you becomes meditation. If you see everyone as an instrument through whom God's will functions, whether you like it or not, that becomes a living meditation. Why? Because witnessing starts happening more and more. Involvement starts lessening. Because who is it that is involved? It is the me. The me is the involvement. And that is why even Sri Aurobindo says that work itself can be a meditation as long as it is not me who is doing the work. The living meditation, the dhyan, not as a practice of half an hour, 1 hour in the morning, and then the rest of the day is a turbulent day, full of thoughts, emotions, dramas, accusations, and so on. Dhyana is the absence of the thinking mind and the cartwheels that it performs during the day. So keeping God as everything around you means your relationships, the events that happen around you, every input is the play of the divine. Knowing that is dhyana. Others are not responsible for what happens to us. They are only instruments for what would happen to us some way or the other. Let us be strong in faith and not succumb to fear. Whatever happens, happens according to our prarabdha. Let it exhaust itself. Evil intentions and evil actions will react themselves and not affect us simply because they desire it. One is required not to think of oneself. So why there be anxiety regarding others? You see, this is precisely it. What happens with this teaching is, if something is meant to happen, the person through whom it happens becomes irrelevant. So you are no longer targeting an individual responsible for happening. The knowing is there deep down that this is all a manifestation of the divine, the Leela. And that is why Nisargadatta Maharaj said that ultimately all individuals are imaginary. That distinction starts going. One's labels one has stuck on to people's foreheads, those start getting peeled away. And what happens is with the acceptance that all this is God, all instruments are divine instruments, whether we like them or not. what happens is the development of an even, neutral, and objective vision, not colored by extreme likes and dislikes. So beautiful, such simple teachings. Beauty in simplicity, so accessible, but sometimes not easy to live by. Why? Because the crust, the hardened crust of conditioning can be very strong. To break through our old patterns, our old processes, and emerge into a new light of understanding is not always a smooth process. But that is why the Guru, the grace of the Guru, the grace of consciousness as the Guru is always available. It is ours for the taking. The questioner asks, what if one meditates incessantly without actions? And Bhagwan says, try and see. The predispositions will not let you do it. Unbroken meditation comes only progressively with gradual weakening of vasanas, the latent tendencies, by the Guru's grace. Dhyana, unbroken meditation, comes only progressively with the gradual weakening of vasanas by the Guru's grace. By the Master's presence, not in words, just mere presence. By the words, by the grace, whatever form it takes, the vasanas, the latent tendencies, the prefixed and preordained patterns, the grace comes in with this new understanding to hammer away at them progressively until, of course, finally when it cracks open, it is sudden and the light flows in. This is another beautiful pointer by Bhagwan. And meditation, once again, to repeat, is a state of being, not a practice. That is what is being referred to. You see, because the latent tendencies get projected out, and with the right understanding and gyan and grace, that starts reducing, that automatic unconscious projection onto others, that starts dissolving. See, Siddharameshwar Maharaj, who was Nisargadatta Maharaj's guru, said, supposing you call someone a thief, and for the next 2 days, let's say that thief has taken your money, all that is going on is the word thief, 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 thief in your consciousness. That means you are now identified with the word thief, which is the content of the consciousness. All that is going on unconsciously. Our thinking, what is it based on? So this is the spiritual birth. When these old grooves start getting reshaped, with the light of understanding and the grace of the Guru. This is the real birth. Otherwise, the birth is in ignorance. Such is the importance of the Guru's teaching. The questioner asks, how is work to be done by an aspirant? Bhagwan answers, Chapter 3, verse 4 of the Bhagavad Gita says that a man cannot remain without acting. The purpose of one's birth will be fulfilled by itself. Gradually, concentration will become pleasant and easy, And you will be in that state, whether attending to business or whether you sit expressly for meditation. Business will be all the more easier for you when your mind is steadied and strengthened. And the questioner asks, this is very relevant to most of us, many of us who are working and engaged in society. I have no interest in business, fearing that my yoga practice will be marred. And Bhagwan replies, no, your viewpoint will change. As it is said in the Gita, you will regard business in the light of a mere dream. But that will not affect it, for you will go on attending to it as it was serious. You see, if work has to happen, it will happen. I am doing the work. That is the problem. Me. To engage in your duty is the true namaskar. To perform one's duty carefully is the greatest service to God. You see, I cannot emphasize this enough because it has been my experience. I started working when I was very young. And my teacher used to love listening to my stories about work because it was a ground to witness the teaching. For me, work was all about relationships. When I was 24 and I took over the business, I was the youngest. My 30 staff members were all older than me. Then we had the clients. Then we had the suppliers, my colleagues. So in a social environment, in urban centers, one is dealing with relationships all the time, especially at work. And that is why he would encourage to be fully engaged in work. And he would love to hear stories of how the teaching helped me see through, you know, certain difficult staff members, for example, and so on and so forth. Work is truly worship. Lessons are to be learned. People think that the motivation for business is profit. That is what we have been conditioned to believe. But the truth is that all relationships happen on account of Rinanubandhan. Many of them are through work. Accounts have to be squared off. I forget the name of this master in North India. And his last days, he spent in the hospital, I think a week or so. And so his devotees told him, Prabhuji, why don't you just rest at home because there is no benefit of being in the hospital. And he said, no, I must go there for my devotees. So his group was quite taken aback and said, but sir, you are going to the hospital. What devotees? He said, no, there are four of them I will be meeting there who will take care of me because our Rinanubandhan is not complete. So do allow me to go. And in a week, this vehicle will be no more. That is what happened. Relationships. And therefore, the teaching of non-doership becomes so important. Because if it is accepted and lived, then the bandhan, the bondage is severed, it's finished. If the blame game stops, if the action-reaction loop ceases to exist in a particular relationship, it takes two hands to clap. If one has the full understanding that action-reaction loop which perpetuates the bondage cannot function anymore, so the rinna is over. Non-doership is the answer. Do not imagine it is you who are doing the work. Think that it is the underlying current which is doing it. Identify yourself with this current. If you work unhurriedly, your work or service need not be a hindrance. It's the same thing, pointing back to the consciousness without which you would not be able to work. So who is really doing the work? That is what Bhagwan is pointing at. Such pragmatic and practical advice for these times. Everything is so relative. So many people grumble about their work. They are not thankful that they still have work to do. You know, a friend of mine is in a profession where he earns perhaps 2 lakhs a week. I don't know how much it is in dollars. 200,000 rupees a week. And 2 years ago, you know, with the demonetization that happened, with the GST which came in, and so on and so forth, he was really in a foul mood. So we met for dinner and I said, "What happened? Why are you looking so great?" And he said that my business is down by 20%. I said, "Don't worry. All businesses, the wheel of fortune keeps turning. It will climb at some point. Be thankful for what you have." And subsequently, when we met, his mood was more and more grave. Now, with the lockdown, his business is down 90% because his work involves crowds. 90%. And you know what he told me? He said, "Now I've understood the value of my business being down only 20%. You see? Now you know. Now you can thank God that your business was down only 20-30%. At that time you were thinking yourself cursed. Everything is so self-centered. One method of securing the temporary cessation of mental activities is association with sages. They are adepts in samadhi, and it has become easy, natural, and perpetual with them. Those moving with them closely and in sympathetic contact gradually absorb the samadhi habit from them." This is the beauty of the spiritual journey, unlike going to a therapist, for example. Association by association. That is why when Maharaj was asked, and I cannot tire of saying this most beautiful statement, when Nisargadatta Maharaj asked, "Is there any benefit in being in the proximity of a sage?" He replied by saying that the trees around the sandalwood tree in a forest start emitting the same fragrance. How can one know a competent guru? And Bhagwan replies, and I love this, by the peace of mind in his presence and by the sense of respect you feel for him. So simple. And this naughty questioner goes on to ask, what is the use of people like you who are sitting still doing nothing when the world is in great trouble? And Bhagwan replies, a self-realized being cannot help benefiting the world. His very existence bestows the highest good to the world. I would like to show you this leaflet that Adarshji sent me of the Ramana Kendra, Delhi. The caption is, if one's mind has peace, the whole world will appear peaceful. Must the guru have a human body? Because you identify yourself with your body, you raise this question. Find out if you are the body. The master appears in order to dispel this ignorance. As Tayu Manavar puts it, the master appears to dispel the ignorance of a man, just as a deer is used as a decoy to capture the lion in the jungle. He has to appear with a body in order to eradicate our ignorance, which is the I am the body idea. Peace is the inner nature of man. If you find it within yourself, you will find it everywhere. You know, I met, or rather attended a Western teacher's talk many, many years ago. And he said, oh, Ramesh Balsekar, all he does is talk about peace of mind. That is kindergarten stuff. One has to go beyond that. One has to go to consciousness, awareness, understanding the difference, and so on and so forth and so forth and so forth. The value of peace is now so clearly explained by Bhagwan himself. Because this is a lived peace. One will know for oneself whether it is a conceptual peace of mind one has or one is living the teaching. What use is it to keep studying and studying and studying the teachings and the scriptures if it is not permeating into one's daily living? Stillness or peace is a realization. Stillness or peace is realization. Nothing more need be said. And finally, I would like to end on these couple of quotes. Where from does the ego rise? And Bhagwan answers, soul, mind, and ego are mere words. They are no true entities of the kind. Consciousness is the only truth. Consciousness is the only truth. Conscious death is the purpose of evolution. And conscious immortality while still in the flesh. Conscious death is the purpose of evolution. The death of the thinking mind based on me and my story. The annihilation of this means the presence of pure being, pure presence. What a beautiful title for the book. The greatest gift one can give someone as such is one's presence. Just being there, without the story, without the dialogue. Being there as consciousness. The greatest gift one can give others is to allow them to be who they are, the way God has created them. Not how I think they should be and behave and act. If one lived this understanding that consciousness is all there is, as Rameshji would say, consciousness is you, me, he, and she. What else but peace would permeate one's being? Finally, this statement of Bhagwan's has given me much peace, especially in my younger days. The ordainer controls the fate of souls in accordance with their prarabdha karma. Whatever is destined not to happen will not happen. Try as you may. Whatever is destined to happen will happen. Do what you may to prevent it. This is certain. The best course, therefore, is to remain silent. I hope you can read it. And by silent, Bhagwan does not mean keeping quiet. He is referring to the silence of the thinking mind that is going into the dead past or an imaginary future. And today, more than ever, it is this imaginary future, this unknown future, perhaps full of turbulence we don't know, which the thinking mind is getting projected towards. And so a statement like this provides a healing balm. So if any of you would like to share anything or ask something in relation to what has been read out, they are most welcome to. And if not, then we will sit in silence for a few minutes before ending this satsang. Yes, Harman.
Namaste, sir. I'm here today attending with my mom, and I have been deeply helped by your teaching, and she also likes your talks. And just seeing what you say, that everything is preordained, it's something which I observe in my life also. And she often asks me that she wants to be happy, but she can't help being sad.
Exactly. Even that is preordained. She can't help it.
Yeah.
You know, there was a shop when I was in London called Lush, which sold all these very fancy natural shampoos and soaps, etc. And they had one soap bar which was called Happy for Sad. I really wonder if it made a sad person happy though, but it was a nice name. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're an Amritsar, right?
Yes.
Okay, remember. Golden Temple, the home of the Golden Temple.
Yes.
Actually, I find that is the most astonishing place, at least one of those that I've visited. A book that is considered the Guru and so sacred and holy and revered, and the procession in which it is carried from its resting place to the temple, it's so touching to see. And the langar, And the water body around the temple, which has absorbed the vibrations of hundreds of years of chants, and the atmosphere is very pristine there. Beautiful.
You are a living temple, so these Sunday meetings have actually become like the Sunday church, which Rameshji used to say.
Yeah, really.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Is there anyone else who would like to ask anything? Or then we can just enter the silent sitting since it's already 5 to 12. I'm just going to change the view so I can see all of you. All right. I do hope to visit Delhi when these visits are possible and be at the Ramana Kendra. I would recommend talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi for anyone who has even the slightest interest in exploring the words of Bhagwan. And I'm reminded of the time when, as Rameshji would say, when anyone would ask Nisargadatta Maharaj in his satsangs whether he had heard of Ramana Maharshi and if there was any difference in their teachings. And Maharaj would reply by saying, the only difference between Ramana Maharshi and me is that I am slightly better dressed. I remember once at Rameshji's satsang, I met a lady who had come from Ramana Ashram. And she said that she ran away from there. So I asked her why. And she said everything was going perfectly well till she saw the samadhi of a dog and a crow. And she said, this is too much. I can't bear this. It's absurd. And I told her why. I said, in fact, as Rameshji would say, the animal has not been given the dubious gift of intellect that makes the human being ask questions. Perhaps it's simpler for them to be in the presence of Bhagwan to receive the ultimate grace, but it was too much for her to handle. And yet, the human being is the only species on the planet that is aware that it is aware. I am. That is a tremendous gift. A gift that gets wasted when we are just caught up in the whirlpool of life and living without going within, which is also, of course, destined till the moment is right, or as Bhagwan says, till one has received enough blows. Death is all around. Not physical death, not just physical death, which is around too right now. At least the newspapers here has pages upon pages of COVID and the testing rate and the death rate and so on and so forth. But there is death all around of the familiar past, of the old way of being. Things are changing, things are shifting. It is the ideal moment to immerse oneself in this precious gift of Advaita.